abuses of power and acceptance of the kind of power dynamic that we've been talking about has become so normal that we don't even see abusive behavior hiding in plain sight. The stories of Harvey Weinstein were all about how he was such a character. He was like an old studio Hollywood head. People did not know the extent of this, but they also didn't know because he continued to make them money, and they would prefer not to find anything out.
Do you think he will go to jail, Harvey Weinstein?
If I had to put
money on it. The New Yorker piece started with three women claim rape.
I think that there seems to be evidence of a crime, but based on past experience and having been covering this for years and years, I would be very shocked if he saw the inside of a jail cell.
Louise Godbold, you have the last 10 seconds.
I am so glad that I haven't been asked, but I'm pressured by you to recount lurid details. I am not a victim. I am a survivor. And by telling my story, it has empowered me. And I encourage other women to take this situation and turn it around and let it empower them so they can experience post-traumatic growth.
I want to thank you all for being with us, Louise Godbold, Tomian Roberts, as well as Irene Carmon. This is Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Up next is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Stand Together Under One Roof on Saturday, October 14th, Rose City Park Presbyterian Church in Portland. Stand Together Under One Roof brings together multiple groups that work for social, racial, and environmental justice to share their purpose, projects, and stories. The day will include short sessions from a variety of groups, a panel, organizational tabling, discussions, networking, and music. Again, that's Stand Together Under One Roof on Saturday, October 14th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Rose City Park Presbyterian Church, 1907 Northeast 45th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Demonstrators as they blocked access to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility in Southwest Portland last night.
A judge has allowed the Dakota Access Pipeline to continue construction while still undergoing an environmental review.
And wildfires in Northern California have killed a confirmed 21 people with hundreds still missing.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 12th, 2017. I'm Tom.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. The actions of the Portland police are once again gaining national attention after disturbing pictures emerged yesterday of officers placing sensory deprivation hoods and headphones on people who were peacefully protesting deportations by Customs and Immigration Enforcement, or ICE. A group of about 50 protesters blocked the driveway at the ICE building on Southwest Macadam Avenue yesterday afternoon in an attempt to prevent vans carrying detainees from leaving the facility. Five protesters from the End Deportation Now collaboration bound their hands together with duct tape, formed a human chain, and sat down in front of the gate. Protesters declined orders from Department of Homeland Security District Commander Luis Lopez to leave Portland. Portland police officers, presumably acting under the orders from Lopez, approached two of the protesters and placed a balaclava-style hood over their heads. The hoods were put on backwards so that the eye holes were towards the back and the victims' faces were completely covered. The police then put noise-canceling headphones on their ears and began cutting the duct tape away. The Portland Police Bureau initially claimed that they had used these extreme methods to protect the protesters from sparks and noise caused by the power tools they used to free them from one another. When it was revealed that officers had not, in fact, used power tools at all, but had cut through the duct tape with tin snips, the Bureau changed its story, admitting that, quote, "The gear protects the protesters' faces and ears. It also prevents the protesters from intentionally causing themselves injury during the removal and or falsely claiming injury to halt the cutting," end quote. After cutting three protesters from the chain, enough that the driveway was cleared that the vehicles could begin exiting the facility. According to the police, some people had been, quote, trapped in their cars for more than an hour and a half, end quote.
These actions raise many serious questions about law enforcement tactics and practices in Portland. For example, why is ICE operating here at all if Portland is a sanctuary city? Is it now commonplace for Portland police officers to function as muscle for the Department of Homeland Security? Who authorized these extreme tactics to be used on our people? Who holds the police accountable when they mislead the public? What recourse do we have to prevent these abuses by police officers? It's increasingly difficult to get answers to these questions in a city with little or no transparency. Yesterday, Willamette Week reported on the huge public records fees journalists and watchdogs must pay to access public records. When they asked for documents connected to an incident where police pepper-sprayed protesters, the mayor's office told them it would cost $3,189 for a set of emails related to the event. The KABU News team had a similar experience when we asked for documents connected to police use of force, only we were told it would cost $5,000. Mayor Wheeler's office did not return our call for comment on this story.
On Wednesday night, California officials ordered all 5,000 residents of Calistoga to evacuate as conditions worsened in wildfires that have now killed 26 people. Geyersville, a town of about 800 people, and the community of Boys Hot Springs, both in Sonoma, were also evacuated. This morning, Sonoma County Sheriff Bob Giordano said that 463 people were still unaccounted for. 900 people have been reported missing since the fire started on Sunday night, but a large number have been located, he added. It's going to continue to get worse before it gets better. State Fire Chief Ken Pimlott said, warning that all the death toll could rise further. The wildfires, fanned by 50 miles per hour wind gusts, have destroyed more than 3,500 buildings and homes spanning 170,000 acres.
It's almost time for the annual open enrollment period for Medicare in Oregon. For more, we go to KABU News and photojournalism intern Isabel Cochran, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service.
Open enrollment for Medicare begins this Sunday, which means about 800,000 participants in Oregon have the opportunity to review their Medicare plans. People across the country have until December 7th to look at making changes to their current plans or to sign up for Medicare. Lisa Emerson, program manager of the Senior Health Insurance Benefits Assistance Program, says people should review their plans for any changes.
Plans change their benefits, they change their premiums, co-pays, deductibles, prescriptions they cover. And so it's important to review because a person could save some money and have better coverage.
People can make a number of changes during open enrollment, including switching between Medicare and Medicare Advantage plans or changing from one standalone prescription drug plan to another. Any changes to plans go into effect at the beginning of next year. Emerson says if people feel comfortable, they can use the tool on the Medicare website to compare plan prices.
They can use the plan comparison tool on Medicare.gov on the website. It's called the Plan Finder tool, which is what Shiva counselors and other benefits counselors would use to compare the myriad of Medicare plans that are available.
Folks can also reach out to Shiba, which has a statewide network of counselors that can help and walk people through the process. The agency also works with local partners to get people the attention they need in person. Oregonians can find Shiba assistance online or by calling 1-800-722-4134. For KABU Evening News, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, I am Isabel Cochran.
At approximately 4 p.m. yesterday, a bomb exploded near the Rock Creek Apartments in Beaverton, close to Northwest 185th Avenue and Rock Creek Boulevard, in a vehicle with a person inside. According to the Washington County Sheriff's Office, the man in the vehicle was 26-year-old Jason Schaefer. Schaefer had been monitored by the FBI for nearly 2 weeks on suspicion that he was violating the terms of his 18-month probation. An arrest warrant was issued hours before the explosion on allegations that Schaefer was a felon in possession of explosives. Schaefer was convicted of attempted second-degree assault and possession of a controlled substance in New York. An FBI agent had called Schaefer's Washington County probation officer on September 25th, reporting that Schaefer had recently bought nitromethane, a highly flammable liquid and remotes used to set off fireworks, and over 100 electric matches. According to court documents, Schaefer had also purchased hexamine, which can be mixed with other chemicals to create a highly explosive compound often used in suicide bombings. Beth Ann Steele, a spokeswoman for the FBI Portland branch, said that after a federal judge approved a search warrant for Schaefer's Rock Creek, Beaverton area apartment, members of the FBI and other law agencies began searching the premises Wednesday morning. Schaefer was called to the Washington County Probation Department to be interviewed by authorities when at some point he stormed out of the office and couldn't be located. A Washington County detective spotted Schaefer driving near his apartment close to 4 p.m. and tried to pull over his SUV. After a short chase along 185th Avenue, the SUV stopped south of Rock Creek Boulevard, where Schaefer took out a small handheld bomb as the detective approached and lit it. The blast knocked the detective back and severely damaged Schaefer's left hand. Both suspect and detective were taken to a hospital that is being kept secret. Investigators found explosives inside Schaefer's apartment that could be detonated remotely. He is accused of violating his probation and could be facing additional charges.
In May, voters in Lincoln County, Oregon, which stretches along the coast from Lincoln City to Yahats, approved a measure banning the aerial spraying of pesticides and herbicides. The new ordinance was almost immediately the subject of a lawsuit brought against the county by Rex Capri, a local farmer, and Wakefield Farms. The citizen group that brought the measure, Lincoln County Community Rights, intervened in the case and has received legal help from the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, or CELDEF. Local activist and author of the book A Bitter Fog, Carol von Strum, also intervened on behalf of the Siletz River ecosystem, one of the few instances of nature itself being party to a court case in the U.S. The first hearing in the case was on Monday before Judge Cheryl Backart. For more, KABU reporter Sam Bowman spoke with Rio Davidson with the group Lincoln County Community Rights.
So I'm speaking with Rio Davidson of the group Citizens for a Healthy County down in Lincoln County, Oregon. Rio, can you just tell us a little bit about what happened Monday morning? You went into, I guess let me give our listeners some background. After the spray ban was approved by voters in May during the special election, or during the primary election. Afterwards, you were sued by Rex Capri and Wakefield Farms down in Lincoln County. And the first court appearance was on Monday. Can you tell us how that went?
Sure. I think it's important to remind folks, too, that who they sued was Lincoln County. And then Lincoln County Community Rights then intervened in this lawsuit. So then, yes, this was the first hearing on the summary judgment for the case there, and it went really well for us, I think. Our lawyer, Ann Nealon, who works with the CELDEF group of lawyers, who's representing Lincoln County Community Rights, she did a wonderful job, you know, representing the people of our county, trying to, you know, stand up to these corporate, I mean, we'll call them corporate aggressors at this point because, you know, here they are. We've outlawed their practice. Now they're suing the county, trying to overturn that law.
Since the measure has passed, has any of it gone formally into effect?
So there is a lot of confusion about that. You can go to our website, Lincoln County Community Rights, and then go to the court documents. They have the documents there. So there is an injunction against just one sentence of the ordinance. The rest of the ordinance is in full effect since the day that it was ratified.
Which sentence is that?
Well, it was one that during the campaign the opposition used to try to stir up a lot of fear. It was revolving around citizen action regarding the enforcement of the ordinance that allowed direct action in case the government courts did not uphold the will of the people.
What's next in this court case?
Now we're just waiting for a decision from Judge Bockart. And once that decision's made, then we'll see. You know, there's definitely a chance that we might not win this case. And there's also a chance that we can. It's basically the first time really in legal precedent in Oregon that corporations are trying to challenge a voted-in law by local citizens. And, you know, the reason it's the first time is because we're basing our right around our Oregon Constitution, so the right for the community to make decisions. And so it's a totally different way of looking at environmental law. Instead of having the regulatory agencies that sometimes can be beholden to the corporate interests involved, it's actually the people making local laws that are put into place by vote of the people. And so this is a really big case. I think the judge realizes that. I think she definitely seemed a little nervous, you know, honestly, talking. And, you know, I think she realizes the implications here that, you know, the whole entire system's been set up to stop communities from making decisions to protect their health, safety, and welfare. And, you know, a lot of this case revolves around state preemption. You know, and these preemption laws, you know, they're basically put into place by corporations. You know, if you go on Alec's website, they have a template for a statewide preemption law, right on their website. It looks pretty similar to a lot of laws that have been passed around the country.
And for our listeners, that's Alec, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And yeah, they do have, they write a lot of model bills that get, from a generally right-wing perspective, that get turned into a lot of state legislation, and a lot of that is available on their website, alec.org. Rio, your group was not the only one to intervene in this case. Carol Van Strum, a resident and a longtime activist on these matters, also intervened on behalf of the Siletz River ecosystem. Has that intervention come into play much, or is that just kind of on the record right now?
Well, unfortunately, the judge did not allow the intervention of the Siletz River ecosystem. That would have been another first time in a U.S. courtroom that the rights of nature were actually recognized. And she wasn't quite ready to make that step, but she did leave it open. It's interesting, if you read her decision there, it's definitely, she leaves it open that that Ann Nealon had a very good argument about why the river should intervene, why the rights of nature should be in place, and how that works in law right now. She had a great argument about that, but the judge felt like the ecosystem's argument would be too similar to Lincoln County community rights argument. And there's rules set in place that to intervene, you have to come up with a different argument that someone is already in the case, and that's the reason that she wouldn't allow Carol Van Strum and the Siletz River ecosystem to intervene in this case.
Rio Davidson with the group Lincoln County Community Rights, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Well, thank you very much, and if anybody wants to get involved, they can come find us at our website, lincolncountycommunityrights.org. Please get involved. Please sign up. This process is getting started, but, you know, depending on what we hear from the judge, you know, this is probably going to get moved up to a higher court from here. So, stay tuned.
For KBOO Community Radio in Portland, I'm Sam Bowman.
About 1 million Oregonians are served by the state's unique Coordinated Care Organization, or CCOs, which bring together physical, mental, and dental health care under one umbrella. It's a unique system, and yesterday marked the 5th year of the state. The state has been using CCOs. Here we are in conjunction with Oregon News Service for more. Oregon's unique approach to bringing together health coverage for state residents is celebrating 5 years. Coordinated Care Organizations, or CCOs, are the umbrellas to an array of services for people on the Oregon Health Plan, the state's version of Medicaid. Erin Fair Taylor is Executive Director of Legal Affairs at Care Oregon, a group that provides health plan services to 4 of these organizations in the state. She says in the pre-CCO world, physical, mental, and dental coverage were all separate and didn't work together.
CCOs now have to really look across and think about what is a whole person's care look like and how can we coordinate that so it's easier to access and that members can have better outcomes and hopefully that we have cost savings as a result of reducing unnecessary care or unnecessary services.
There are 16 CCOs in the state, all of them working regionally to provide local care. They serve about 1 million Oregonians. Fair Taylor says CCOs are required to come up with a community health improvement plan every 3 years. These organizations work with local schools, health departments, and even the criminal justice system on these plans. She says the close work with the communities makes CCOs particularly adept to respond to crises, such as the opioid epidemic or the housing crisis, because they get to hear from local people directly.
Where are their overlaps? What's happening on the ground? Where are there opportunities for us to either better communicate or collaborate? And where are there opportunities for us to build additional infrastructure or really build together the things that could meaningfully impact the health of this particular community?
Since CCOs were created and the Affordable Care Act was passed nationally, Oregon's uninsured rate has plummeted from 17 to 5%. Fair Taylor says the biggest hurdle going forward will be the state's budget. As Oregon tightens its belt, CCOs have to as well. She says organizations will do that in part by promoting preventative care services.
If we can keep people healthy, that's much less expensive than paying for emergency room visits or conditions that could otherwise have been prevented. So that's where we're going first to manage our budget concerns.
In conjunction with the Oregon News Service and KBOO Evening News, I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Standing Rock Sioux and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes are disappointed in a court decision allowing oil to continue to flow in the Dakota Access Pipeline. On Wednesday, a federal judge ruled operations of the pipeline can continue as an environmental study is conducted. The tribes have been fighting to shut down the pipeline, saying it threatens water and infringes on treaty rights. According to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, the court did express a willingness to consider other measures to protect the tribe while operations continue. It's been almost a year since the Eastern Shoshone tribe released its first 10 bison onto 300 acres of land on the Wind River Reservation. The tribe now plans to release more. As Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, this time the animals will come from the National Bison Range in Montana instead of Iowa, like the last herd.
Jason Baldes with the Eastern Shoshone Tribal Buffalo Restoration Program says the goal is to build a genetically pure herd by getting wild bison from different places.
By bringing in a population from another area with similar genetics in that they're pure, we're able to increase the genetic heterogeneity of our own population here on the Wind River Reservation. That'll be important so that we have different gene pools that we can draw from that makes our herd healthier.
Baldes says the herd's first bison calf was born last year, moving the project in small steps towards the goal of 1,000 animals managed on the reservation as wild game. Baldes says going forward, the tribe plans to study the benefits bison bring to the reservation's ecosystem.
We're really curious to see what the ecological changes are going to be over time because we know that buffalo or bison increase plant biodiversity as well as many other species such as amphibians and birds and arthropods, bugs. And so we want to see what these changes are over time.
The tribe is working in collaboration with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Wildlife Foundation. A ceremony will be held for the release on October 21st, and artist Arturo Garcia will document the event with a painting. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards in Laramie.
Native American swimmers gathered in California this week to take part in an annual swim across San Francisco Bay. As Jim Kent reports, the early morning event is part of a health and nutrition program aimed at Native Americans, which dates back 15 years.
San Francisco resident and swimmer Nancy Iverson founded the PathStar program after working as a pediatrician at the IHS hospital on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
I was really discouraged by what's going on with obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and how little effective intervention has been done for it.
The mission of PathStar is to inspire and revitalize sustainable health and well-being practices within Native American communities by providing experiential learning opportunities. Those opportunities include spending a week with Iverson in San Francisco, learning healthy eating and living practices, and training to swim across San Francisco Bay.
If they came out here and trained, they could swim from Alcatraz. They could actually have an incredible success.
Samantha White is Lakota from Pine Ridge. She completed Iverson's program and swam San Francisco Bay this week.
It was awesome. Like, the people were just amazing, especially the women that I swam with.
Samantha White plans to take what she learned about healthy eating and living home with her and add it to the positive lifestyle she's already leading. A total of 95 swimmers from 20 tribes in 10 different states have taken part in the PathStar program. I'm Jim Kent.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by AARP. What we do might surprise you, like sponsoring the Alaska Federation of Natives in Anchorage, Alaska, October 19th through the 21st. Information at aarp.org.
Yate, the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the Navajo Nation Advanced Ed 2017 Fall Conference, November 4th and 5th. Information on this event and services at siabq.org. Hakoanea.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report. We are having a live interview with members from Doctors Without Borders. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, and at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will be partly rainy with a low of around 45 degrees, followed by a little bit of the same tomorrow. East of the Cascades and Hood River, it'll be a little rainy with a high of around in the upper 50s and a low in the upper 30s. Today in history, Arthur Dent showed us that there are worse things than being evicted and the importance of always traveling with a towel when the first of the five-book trilogy, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, written by Douglas Adams, was published in the year 1979. The quote of the day is from Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. "The president is always a controversial choice, always an infuriating but fascinating character. His job is not to wield power, but to draw attention from it."
It's 5:27, time for commentary from Jim Hightower.
The governors of many states are boldly stepping forward these days to stop grassroots democracy. Yes. Noting that local citizens and officials have been passing local laws to govern themselves, a flock of right-wing governors are asserting an autocratic power called state preemption to overrule democratic decisions made by locals. Why do these governors hate democracy? Because their corporate funders don't like some of the laws local people support. So democracy must go. This is not a matter of a rogue governor here or there, but a coordinated effort by corporate interests to get governors to usurp local authority. The main coordinator of this power grab is ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. For example, in 2014, when Fight for 15 and other activist groups began winning city campaigns for minimum wage hikes, ALEC responded by holding a corporate forum on how state officials can stop such local actions. ALEC circulated a model bill called the Living Wage Preemption Act, and sure enough, it's already been passed by nearly half of our states. Ohio was the latest. By a large margin, people in the Buckeye State favor raising the wage floor, and Cleveland enacted its own increase last year. But a small group of corporate profiteers howled in fury. So last December, the state's Republican leaders rushed to appease them by adapting the ALEC preemption bill and ramming it into law. It was a political mugging of the people's will, retroactively negating Cleveland's increase and outlawing increases by any other locality. This is Jim Hightower saying, used sparingly and properly, preemption can be a democracy-enhancing tool to serve the common good. But when governors pervert this power to use it as a cudgel against the people, we the people must rise up against the governors. To learn more, visit mayorsinnovation.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
As the storm of tweets and counter-tweets continue to rage around the subject of federal support to Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, reports of damages on the island continue to mount. Nearly 3 weeks after the hurricane hit, almost 90% of Puerto Rico still lacks electricity, and the death toll has risen to 45. At least 113 people remain unaccounted for, according to a spokeswoman for Puerto Rico's Department of Public Safety. Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Chris Krebs was optimistic, quote, "We are making progress, but we can do more," end quote. Krebs said that there were 17,000 military and civilian responders, over 100 helicopters, water trucks in every one of the 78 municipalities, and over 50 generators installed in critical facilities. But President Trump tweeted this morning that FEMA and the U.S. military can't stay in Puerto Rico forever. The mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulén Cruz, tweeted back, quote, "Help us. Without robust and consistent help, we will die," end quote.
The historically prevalent plotline of people in power using their status to cover up sex crimes with their status and platoons of legal teams and public relations mouthpieces has just taken a hit. Ronan Farrow's high-profile takedown of Hollywood heavyweight Harvey Weinstein in the New York Times has unleashed a number of follow-up confessions from other alleged victims of Weinstein's. Known to many members of the Hollywood elite and hopefuls for years, Farrow's report showed that there was an underlying conspiracy amongst employees at Miramax to cover up and even lure people in to Weinstein's hotel rooms for what were to be interviews and what ended up being traumatic sexual assaults or advances. The heavy legal team surrounding Weinstein has made it very difficult for survivors to come forward because many of them have had to sign ironclad non-disclosure agreements in order to go forward or even have a career in the field that they have pursued. Ronan Farrow, the reporter who published the piece in the New York Times, is the son of actress and activist Mia Farrow and acclaimed director Woody Allen. 20 years ago, the Farrow family underwent a vicious custody battle and PR assault after Allen was caught with sexually explicit photos of one of Farrow's adopted daughters, who was of age at the time, followed by accusations of sexual abuse from one of Farrow's youngest daughters, Dylan Farrow. This story was almost published in a TV format at NBC around 6 months ago, but was rejected as not quite up to snuff. Farrow has argued that the piece was ready and explosive, but that the network wanted nothing to do with it.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. The NFL Players Association says that NFL players are union members and part of the labor movement that has woven the fabric of America for generations. The Players Union says some players have decided to use their platform to peacefully raise awareness to issues that deserve attention. The NFL Players Association says we should not stifle these discussions and cannot allow our rights to become subservient to the very opinions our Constitution protects. Meanwhile, WBAP 820 AM in Fort Worth, Texas, says that Local 100 of United Labor Unions is filing NLRB charges against Dallas Cowboys owner Jerry Jones over the NFL player protests.
That union says NFL players have the right of concerted action to protest under the National Labor Relations Act. The complaint says Jones's efforts now to force players not to protest during the national anthem violates the players' rights to concerted action under the NLRA. A planned strike by hundreds of part-time faculty at Tufts University got canceled Wednesday when a tentative new labor agreement was reached. SEIU Local 509 says the five-year tentative deal improves wages and teaching conditions for the part-time faculty. Part-time faculty at Tufts voted to unionize in 2014. More than half of the part-time faculty will see pay raises of 22.5% over the five-year agreement. Others will get a minimum of 12.5% pay hikes. Finding themselves constrained by a legal challenge to their efforts to form a union at the University of Minnesota, faculty there are moving away from the traditional NLRB union election model and to a workers' association instead. Anna Kerhajic is a lecturer in American Studies at the University of Minnesota.
We wanted to start doing things that actually could, you know, get us some wins and build some organizing around issues, find opportunities to build solidarity with other workers and students on campus. So we talked about moving away from the traditional unionization model and going towards the workers' association, which for us opens up a lot of possibilities. We're really, really excited about it.
Kerhajic says the legal challenge would have divided faculty along class lines between tenure and non-tenure contingent faculty. That class difference was unacceptable to pro-union faculty.
Across the board at all of our meetings, tenure-track faculty refuse to be classed differently than our colleagues who have contingent appointments, a really important step of solidarity for us.
University of Minnesota faculty are hoping that their workers' association enables solidarity and more powerful organizing with many other workers beyond the faculty. WIN is America's multimedia news voice for workers.
We need to make more money. You know, what they're paying us, the greedy corporations, they just want to pay us what they want to pay us. And it's not right.
Support WIN's worker news mission at workersindependentnews.com. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
From our friends at the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show, here's Labor History in Two.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1899. That was the day union miners in Mount Olive, Illinois, began commemorating Miners' Day. Every year, thousands came into town for a parade, music, and speeches. Mount Olive was the site of the only union-owned cemetery in the United States, established by UMWA Local 728 in the aftermath of the Verdun Massacre. A year before to the day, striking miners had been killed in a shootout with company goons attempting to herd scabs into the mines in Verdun, Illinois. But, as Mother Jones biographer Elliot Gorn notes, the train never unloaded its cargo and the company was forced to settle. The union hoped to erect a gravesite monument commemorating those miners who had been killed at Verdun, but they were refused by those who considered the fallen miners to be murderers and not martyrs. That's when the United Mine Workers established the Union Miners Cemetery, and on this day, 10,000 turned out for the union's memorial ceremony. The United Mine Workers unveiled a monument dedicated to the fallen Verdun miners E.W. Smith, Joe Gitterly, Ernest Kramer, and E.F. Long. The day was filled with parades, music, laying of wreaths, and speeches. Haymarket widow and radical activist Lucy Parsons was among the speakers. In his book, Death and Dying in the Working Class, Michael Rosnow notes that her presence drew a direct connection between the fallen miners and the Haymarket martyrs, cut down while advancing the cause of labor. Thousands traveled to Mount Olive every year for celebrations, including Eugene V. Debs, miners' leader John Mitchell, and Mother Jones. In 1923, Mother Jones asked to be buried with her boys, noting they are responsible for Illinois being the best organized labor state in America.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
For months, there have been reports on what the U.S. has called sonic attacks on personnel at the U.S. Embassy in Havana, but U.S. and Cuban investigations have produced no evidence of any weapon. The unexplained incidents have prompted the U.S. to withdraw most of its embassy staff from Havana and expel the majority of Cuban diplomats from Washington. Now neurologists have suggested that the wave of mysterious ailments among the diplomats could be the result of, quote, mass hysteria rather than sonic attacks. According to Mark Hallett, the head of the Human Motor Control Section of the U.S. National Institute of Neurological Disorders and stroke mass hysteria could explain the symptoms Hallett and other scientists call this a psychogenic effect. John Stone, a University of Edinburgh neurologist, has said, quote, mass psychogenic illness is by far the most plausible explanation, end quote.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imc.org for Wednesday, October 11th, 2017. Israeli settlers and army attacks leave three Palestinians injured during drone invasions. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Three Palestinians were injured on Wednesday night in clashes that erupted with Israeli occupation forces when Israeli settlers raided Joseph Tomb in Nablus City. Local witnesses reported that more than 30 buses of Israeli settlers stormed the tomb, escorted by a large group of Israeli soldiers. Clashes erupted as Palestinian youth tried to confront Israeli soldiers, who responded by firing rubber-coated steel bullets. Three Palestinians were injured. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of Israeli settlers stormed the Ibrahimi Mosque as well in Hebron for the second day in a row under tight protection of the Israeli police and special units. Earlier on Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded Shweika area and Bal'a town near the northern West Bank city of Tul Karim, searched homes and abducted two Palestinians. Also at dawn, the soldiers invaded many homes in the West Bank governorates of Bethlehem, photographed homes, and threatened further collective punishment. In other news, the Israeli occupation government has approved a series of settlement plans, including 12,000 new settlement units in 2017, four times the number in 2016, Israeli news sources reported Wednesday. The settlement units would be located throughout the West Bank, including Hebron, the Migron settlement, and Beit Il settlement near Ramallah in the West Bank, the sources added. Settlement building in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem is illegal under international law. Currently, there are more than 500,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was a Wednesday, October 11th, 2017, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tom Flynn, Isabel Cochran, Jasmine Moneymaker, and Grace Ann Smith. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is Ben Shiregi. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Grace Ann Smith.
And I'm Tom. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting, Ani and Lynn welcome your calls. At 9, Beloved Community addresses the philosophical and spiritual foundations for nonviolence, activism, political engagement, and peacebuilding. At 10, Threshold Shift travels to Rocky Mountain National Park to listen in on the annual Fall Elk Run. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Digital Divide aims to use science, medicine, and technology to benefit society and keep them from harming us. KBOO is your independent source for news and entertainment. Become a member. Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
What would you do if war came to your home and you were forced to escape? What challenges would you encounter on your journey? And what belongings would you take? How would you start a new life when what you thought of as home no longer existed? Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, is an organization founded in 1971 and dedicated to bringing medical aid wherever it is most needed, independently, neutrally, and ethically. The nonprofit will be traveling through Portland with a free outdoor exhibition on the global refugee crisis, Pioneer Courthouse Square, titled Forced from Home. Through this project, Doctors Without Borders seeks to expose the realities of the crisis. With an experienced aid worker as a guide, visitors will be able to navigate 10,000 square feet of space that reenacts the route of a displaced person from Afghanistan, Burundi, Honduras, South Sudan, or Syria. We have in the studio with us Leah Battersby, MSF logistician, pardon me, word's kind of hard, who has completed 4 missions with Doctors Without Borders, including 2 emergency missions, and Ebum, emergency medical doctor who has more than 4 years of experience with Doctors Without Borders in Nigeria. Welcome.
Leah and Ebum, welcome to KBOO. Where has your service with Doctors Without Borders taken you? Why don't you start, Ebum?
Oh, well, it's in the meantime, I work in Nigeria and West Africa as well as an emergency medical doctor responding to outbreaks and other issues within the country. So this is what I've been up to so far.
How about you, Leah?
I've worked in Myanmar, Tajikistan, Sierra Leone, and last I was in Tanzania, Western Tanzania.
And what different challenges did each place hold? I guess the first.
Go ahead, Ebum.
Oh, well, for me, it's mostly been a local response. My experience has mostly been a local response. But there's been a lot going on, that said, having worked through different projects, you know, responding to different outbreaks like measles, meningitis, cholera, and also having to deal with lots of malnourished children, you know, as a result of insurgency in the Northeast currently. So it's been quite challenging, to say the least. But again, it's been reassuring having to be part of the response MSF puts together. So it's generally been reassuring.
And I guess working in so many different locales, you face different things. I'm a logistician, so I'm more looking at the supply. I support the medical teams, whatever they need. So in Myanmar, we had all our transport was by boat. So our warehouse was a boat. Our medical teams went out on the long-tail boat. So that was quite interesting. And then in Sierra Leone, it was Ebola, so we had the biohazard. And then last, I was construction manager. And so just, you know, using the local resources and adjusting to them.
Leah, you said you were in Myanmar. Did you deal with the Rohingya people?
No, I actually was there in 2008 after Cyclone Nargis. So we were doing emergency response.
Right. And Ebum, I wanted to ask you, Nigeria is a big country, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And you're in the Northeast.
Yeah.
Is that the part where there are both Muslim and Christian people in conflict?
Yeah, that's the part. Like, generally in the North, you have a predominantly Muslim population, okay? And then there's still, yeah, some Christians there as well. But yeah, there's usually occasional crisis, yeah, between the Muslims and the Christians. That's
correct. How do you guys function when you're in some conflict like that where you're dealing with two different people of two different religions and beliefs, and they're clashing with each other? How do you get out of the middle of that?
Well, very recently, that has not been the case in our responses so far. Most of the crisis we've had has not been linked with religion. It's more about insurgency. So that's what we've had to deal with, like, lately.
Who are the insurgents?
Well, like the Boko Haram sect.
Boko Haram.
That's right.
And then, what was your initial calling to this? I know in the United States, you think being a doctor, you'll make a lot of money, and that, like, what called you to go out to that field, to Doctors Without Borders?
Well, for me, I hadn't heard of it. I'm actually from Canada, in the Yukon Territory, and I was working with a French-Canadian colleague, and he told me about Medicine Sans Frontières, and I love to travel, and I've always wanted to work in the humanitarian sector, and I didn't think it'd be possible for a carpenter from the Yukon, so I was pretty excited when I applied and saw I qualified, and then I was accepted.
Yeah. You're a carpenter?
Yes, I'm actually a certified carpenter and a certified sheet metal mechanic, or HVAC tech.
A woman of many skills. And do you have to be bilingual to work for Doctors Without Borders?
No. I'm working on my French, un peu. It's very small, but no. Although if you have a second language or a third or a fourth, it's... You have way more options, and you can work in many places.
When Leah said that, she pointed to Ibam. How many languages do you speak, Ibam?
Well, yeah, but just to disappoint you, I don't speak any other international language. But locally, yeah, I speak about three different languages, locally speaking. Right.
So he speaks four languages.
Okay. Well, you guys are here to talk about some kind of exhibit. It sounds fascinating. It's called Forced from Home. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you build that, or what's it like? What's the Forced from Home? What does that mean?
Well, I get to build the dome. The second station, the first one's an introduction. The second station is a 360 dome. So they have it basically as a video that's over head height, and you can see all around you and what it's like to be in these different contexts. So they have refugees and they have field workers talking about the different
places. Wait a minute. This is a room you go into, right?
Yeah, so it's actually a dome we made out of aluminum pieces, and then we have these big panels. So you walk inside it, it's dark, and then we turn on the video, and it's a very amazing video. It gives you a really good idea of what it's like to be there.
Where is this exhibit?
At Pioneer Square.
Pioneer Square.
Yeah, but just to add a bit to what she said, it's not just a dome, right? It's one of the stations, yeah?
So yeah, there's actually...
She's a carpenter. She thinks about domes.
That's what I set up, so... Yeah.
So it's an outdoor exhibition that takes you through different stations.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. And it's free, okay? So, we just speak about everything that goes on in camps, all right? And then we speak about the situations refugees... exposed to, you know, we use each of the stations to emphasize certain points. They're just generally speaking about their general situations, using one station at a time to emphasize the problems that go through.
What do you mean by stations? I don't quite get that.
So each guide actually takes a group through. So you have different spots that you stop. Say from my dome, you go to one called Push Factors. So for the exhibit, the people, someone going in it is actually a displaced person. So you're given a card and you're identified either a migrant, asylum seeker, refugee. And then you go through the stations, and the idea is to Push Factors is, why did you leave your home? Because people, you know, you have businesses, like in Syria, most people, they're middle class, well-educated, living normal lives, or you're a farmer, just carrying along, and then what makes you leave? So we go through the different things, and then there's another section about how people travel.
Yeah, and then there's another station where we talk about what happens when you make it to your temporary abode, like to the borders. You know, you want to know what your legal status is at the point of arrival. And then we also proceed to another station where we talk about basic needs. You know, like at some point you have to take cards, you know, when you flee from whatever push factors there. So we would check again at some point with you. I know the items you left with, you fled with, are supposed to be items you should embark on the journey with, you know, but you would lose them, you know, at different points in the flow. All right. And then when we get to the basic needs stations, we talk about what you would need to proceed again with.
Well, I'm beginning to understand. It sounds like a very interactive kind of experience, right?
That's
and it's
right,
right there in Pioneer Square. And our listeners could go to Pioneer Square and get into a line. And do they have to pay to get in?
No, you do not.
You don't have to pay. That's, and it's meant to educate them about the experience of the people that you're dealing with in places where you work.
That's right.
From these different issues of losing your property or getting lost or crossing a border, things like that.
That's right.
Are you two there to talk with the people? Or
yes, both of us are guides. All of the tour guides are field workers, so they've worked and they've worked in these contexts, in refugee camps, they've worked with displaced people.
And what is, or how many people are currently displaced worldwide?
There's
over 65 million people displaced at present. That's a huge number.
Yeah, how many Los Angeleses are that, do you think, Tom?
That's about 10. Or
10 LAs.
You said 65 million people.
That's right. Well, over 65
million.
Yeah.
Wow. I just want to get back to the exhibit for a second. Where it's the dome. That sounds fascinating. And you built it, right?
Well, I put it together, yes.
You put it together. Yeah. What is it? What's it like?
Well, it's enclosed space. It's basically built out of aluminum. It's like a geodome.
Yeah.
Then we have the panels on the inside. And then we have basically a nice tarp that says MSF on the outside. But what it is it's really about the videos. They've shot the video in a way that you can see everything around you. So when you walk into Nduta camp, you see the trees, you see the canvas tents people live in. And it's life size. So I think it's the best way actually to understand what it looks like without being there.
Cool. It's a 360 degree video experience then.
Exactly.
And is it a simulation of one place or is it a conglomeration of places?
It's all the places. So the five countries.
All the five countries.
That we're talking about. Yes.
Oh, that sounds really interesting. Is your primary purpose to educate people or to raise money or both or what?
It's to raise awareness.
Raise awareness.
Yeah. So we do talk about MSF and the work we do. So we have two tents about medical issues that displaced people face and what kind of responses we do. But our focus, because one of our principles in MSF is bearing witness, and so our focus is to raise awareness on the refugee crisis. Of course, people are welcome to donate, but at the end, we encourage to support organizations that are working with refugees, not just MSF.
And have you all done this in any other cities?
I was just in Seattle.
Yeah, I was in Seattle as well, but we had done it elsewhere, Boulder, and
we were in
Salt Lake as well.
Yeah. How was the turnout there? And
Good. Yeah, and the weather was pretty poor apparently in Salt Lake, and we had over 800 people on Sunday, I think. Yeah.
What kind of people would you want to have come ideally? I mean, like everybody, but to kind of educate the American public with this, you know?
Well, MSF, we welcome everybody, work with everybody. I think anyone who's interested, and especially people who maybe have concerns, questions. We don't want just people who are, you know, agree completely with us, because the idea is we want to share what we've seen out in the field. And definitely if people have questions at the end, because it's quite fast, we have 6 minutes in each station. We have a spot where you chat with your guides. You can talk about things, ask questions.
Ebem, you said you're in the area where you work is the place where Boko Haram occupies. Is that right?
Yes.
They're the ones who kidnapped all those young girls, right?
Yes.
Has that been resolved?
Well, that's something that's still ongoing. You know, it's not something conveniently speak about, because it's more political than related to the issues we address. So as MSF, right. We're more concerned with the humanitarian response as a result of the displacement of the population.
Right. I'm sorry, I get off on these tangents, but yeah, that's a story that fascinates me, and I wonder how it's what it's like to work in a place where these people can come in and wreak havoc with you.
Yeah, I mean, there's not working in this context doesn't come without this risk. You know, this is what we do as MSF. You know, working, right. Getting to places where other people can't get to.
And you're an emergency medical doctor. You must be on the front lines of care then.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
Well, we're a logistician and an emergency medical doctor. Do you guys work together at all when you're back in the field, or you're coming together for this project?
Well, we just met in this project, but it's very likely we will work together in the future.
Good.
And actually, from my team in Nduta refugee camp, where I was in Western Tanzania, we're going to have Sachin. He was a medical team leader. Colleen, who was a medical doctor, emergency doctor also. And then my logistical team leader is going to be in Oakland. She is awesome. She's from Alaska.
Where's your next assignment, Leah?
It sounds like I'm going to Syria. They're rebuilding a 400-bed hospital, so I'm probably going to leave in November.
And Ebom, you're going back to Nigeria?
Yeah, I'm going back to Nigeria to wrap up a cholera intervention.
Wow, sounds amazing. We could talk to you so much more. But we do have to wrap up. And just for our public, so that people can attend this, could you tell us one more time where it's at, when it's at, and how you get to do it?
So it's Force from Home. It's an exhibit in Pioneer Square. It starts on Monday and goes through Sunday.
And you can just show up anytime during the day?
Eight to six, typically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Six.
And we have so many guides that every 8 minutes we're there to put on a tour. So please come. We're here. We're happy to share what we.
And it's free. No entry.
No.
And
yeah.
You'll get to meet Liam and Abram.
Yes.
Hopefully.
Yeah, we'll
if you're lucky.
You definitely will see it.
All of the guides are good, though.
Great to have you with us today. We hope you get wonderful attendance. I think you will. People will be interested in this. This is so exciting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
All right.
The time is 6:00. Up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling